More Palestinians have been forced to move, have been displaced than what happened at the Nakba at the time of the founding of Israel. What gives you hope? You are an Israeli historian esteemed throughout the world. You have less than a minute.
Yes. I would say that what gives me hope is that I do think that the Zionist project in Israel and Palestine, as we see it today, doesn't have long to live, to exist. I think we are seeing processes, important processes, that are leading to the collapse of the Zionist project. Hopefully, the Palestinian National Movement and anyone else involved in Israel and Palestine would be able to replace this apartheid state, this oppressive regime, with a democratic one for everyone who lives between the river and the sea, and for all the Palestinians who were expelled from there since 1948 until today. I believe that this historical process has begun. Unfortunately, it will take time, and the next year or two are very precarious and are very dangerous, but in the long run, I'm really hopeful that there will be a different kind of life for both Jews and Arabs between the river and the sea under a democratic, free Palestine.
Ilan Pappe, Professor of History and Director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Happy belated birthday to Samin Farkanday and today to Tay Maria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. What that means is that 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during the last week of our spring membership drive, your support can go even farther. Contribute today at bit.ly/KBOO. That's bit.ly/KBOO. And your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now and help us reach our $60,000 goal by May 25th. Thanks so much.
I'm Grace Gerling, Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's primary election day in Oregon. Voters must turn in their ballots to an official drop box by 8 p.m. Multnomah County says residents should be on the lookout for a phone scam claiming to be the sheriff's department. And Portland city officials ask a judge to overrule a jury verdict that found them liable for the police killing of Michael Townsend. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. KBOO is in the final days of our spring membership drive, so we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. I'm Eric Leuschner. Today, Tuesday, May 21st, is the final day for Oregonians to cast their vote in the state's primary election. Fewer than 40% of Oregon's registered voters are expected to cast their ballots. That means the results of the election will be less representative of the voting population. But it's not uncommon in years without much contention over Democratic and Republican presidential nominations. This year is pretty similar to 2018. Compare that to 2016, when the Democratic and Republican primaries were more contested than turnout was up to 54%. Outside of the presidential campaign, Democratic voters have important decisions to make in federal congressional races. Voters will decide who will be nominated for retiring U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer in Oregon's 3rd Congressional District, as well as who will face Republican Lori Chavez DeRemer in Oregon's 5th in the fall. These races have attracted national attention over the flood of outside spending into congressional campaigns. Major party voters will also decide who runs for Secretary of State and Attorney General. Voters of all affiliations will choose county commissioners, district attorneys, and sheriffs, among other nonpartisan public officials around the state. Voters have until Tuesday at 8 p.m. to submit their ballots. Ballots can be dropped into official ballot collection bins by this evening. Voters can find an official ballot drop box near them by going online to sos.oregon.gov/voting or by calling their local county elections official. Ballots that were postmarked by Tuesday will also be counted, which means final results in these races won't be completely tallied until later next week. Preliminary results will be released at 8 p.m. this evening. Oregon will start distributing funds to support early childhood learning soon. The state has fallen behind in literacy measures in recent years. Eric Tagadoff has the details.
Oregon is poised to distribute funds for early childhood learning and literacy. In 2023, lawmakers passed the Early Literacy Success Initiative, in part because only about half of the state's students were proficient in reading through third grade. School districts have since applied for grants with the Oregon Department of Education, and funds are expected soon. Dr. Marina Merrill with the Children's Institute says the investments are exciting because brains develop faster in a person's first 8 years of life than at any other point.
Those years are just so critical, especially that 90% of a child's brain is developed by the age of 5. Yet, most of our investments in young children start at age 5.
Grant applications from more than 200 districts and charter schools have focused on building a capacity for early literacy through professional development and coaching. The Children's Institute is holding a webinar tomorrow about the state's investments in evidence-based early learning practices. Dr. Herb Turner is the founder of Analytica and will participate in the Children's Institute webinar. He says evidence-based practices are ones that have been studied and shown to improve students' outcomes, meaning they can be used with confidence in the classroom.
Oregon deserves a lot of credit for taking this on and for creating this emphasis on evidence-based practices and strategies and getting behind evidence-based reading initiatives.
Cecia Vega Lopez is a pre-K teacher at the bilingual school Echo Shaw Elementary in Cornelius, outside Hillsboro. She used different practices to teach literacy, such as highlighting each letter of the alphabet with an animal that starts with that letter. She says this is a critical time for kids.
For them to be able to have this knowledge early on really helps support their learning as they move on through their trajectory of school, especially as they move on to kindergarten. So I think the focus on them learning or being aware of language is very important in their overall development.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Multnomah County Auditor's Office is advising residents that there is a phone scam going around with a caller claiming to be from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. A community member reported they got a call from someone saying they were a sheriff's deputy and that they needed to pay them $3,000 from an ATM or they would be arrested. The auditor advises in a press release to, quote, if you are called by a person claiming to be from the sheriff's office and they are requesting payment in any capacity, do not send money or engage with these individuals. Just hang up. They do not represent the sheriff's office, end quote. The sheriff's office says that some scammers have faked a sheriff's office caller ID, used actual employee names, gave a fake badge number, or saying they must pay their fine with a gift card, Cash App, or cryptocurrency to avoid being arrested. The auditor's office also notes that if people have been a victim of this scam, that they should file a police report by calling the non-emergency number for the county. That phone number is 503-823-3333. Earlier this month, a Multnomah County jury found the city of Portland was liable for negligence in the police shooting of Michael Townsend. Their verdict was $1 million. Penance for a Portland officer shooting and killing a man in a mental health crisis. Now, Portland City Attorney wants a judge to overrule that jury's findings. They say the jury's verdict isn't, quote, legally supported by evidence, end quote. the city attorney asks for a retrial or a total overrule by the judge. In 2021, Townsend called 911 saying he felt suicidal and had taken methamphetamine. He wanted a ride to the hospital. When officers arrived, he appeared to change his mind about going to the hospital twice, court records say. When officers went to leave, he became agitated after they had asked to pat him down, taking out a sharpened tool. Officer Curtis Brown then took out his gun and shot Townsend. The jury sided with the prosecution, which argued that Brown didn't follow state use of force law that was updated in 2020. By that law, officers must, quote, consider alternatives before using force. That could include things like verbal de-escalation, waiting, or using less lethal force. It will be a few weeks before the judge rules on the city's motion to overrule the verdict. Townsend's sister, one of the plaintiffs, said most of the verdict's money will be donated to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. States in the West are seeing an increased number of fire weather days. One expert says the changes are mainly being driven by human-caused climate change. Alex Gonzalez has more from Utah.
A new report finds that climate change is affecting weather conditions in ways that increase wildfire risk, with the West seeing the greatest jump in fire weather days in spring and summer. Climate Central found that parts of Utah are experiencing around three more weeks of fire weather days during the summer. Caitlin Trudeau with Climate Central says fire weather refers to the meteorological conditions that kickstart the spread of fire. And with Utah being one of the states seeing more days with persistent hotter temperatures, lower relative humidity, and stronger winds, it's something that Trudeau says is worrisome.
We look at which variables, what's really changing this. We're seeing that it's really relative humidity. We're seeing a huge increase in the number of these really dry days. One of the main reasons for that is climate change. It's getting warmer. It's getting quite warmer, especially in the Southwest.
Trudeau says warmer air can hold more water, and that as the temperature increases, the atmosphere gets thirstier, which can then pull more moisture out of the landscape. She adds that as we continue to see the increasing influence of human-caused climate change, Trudeau contends humans need to rethink their impact on the environment. She says she hopes the report will serve as a wake-up call and also help people understand risks where they live. The U.S. Fire Administration has a list of 7 steps communities can enact in an effort to be more prepared. Trudeau adds that other fire adaptation strategies include increased use of land management techniques, such as prescribed burns, that eliminate excessive fuels, but even those have become more of a challenge.
And in order to do prescribed burning, you have to have a very specific set of weather conditions. And they're basically the opposite of fire weather conditions, because it's really dangerous to burn anything when you have really hot, dry, windy days.
Trudeau says that as the number of fire weather days increase, that also decreases the ability to do things like prescribed burning. She encourages people around the country to create defensible space around their homes, as well as create toolkits and an evacuation plan in case of an emergency. For Utah News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Republicans may use the phantom of non-citizen voters to overturn the election. Supreme Court Justice Alito's display of an upside-down American flag reignites calls for an ethics code, and Missouri Dems filibuster for abortion rights. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's like hygiene. You got to brush your teeth every day. Elections administrators should be working on list maintenance every day of the week as well.
Republican Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose says a recent check of the 8 million names on the state's voter rolls found fewer than 140 non-citizens. He says they likely registered by accident. According to an analysis by the conservative Cato Institute, laws already on the books barring non-citizen voting work well, so it almost never happens. But critics say even looking for it perpetuates the conspiracy theory that non-citizen voting could rig the presidential race. New York Democratic Congressman Joe Morelli says right-wing extremists and supporters of former President Donald Trump are laying the groundwork to try to overturn the 2024 election.
They want Americans to be afraid. They want Americans to believe Donald Trump's inevitable excuses, his torrent of lies about fraud when he once again leads the Republican Party down a path of insurrection.
Democrats in Congress want Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito to recuse himself from two election cases after the public display of an upside-down American flag at his home ahead of President Joe Biden's inauguration. Alito has so far refused and blames his wife for displaying a signal used in the January 6th insurrection. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin says without a binding ethics code, change is up to the public.
We're going to have to try to deal with this through elections and the assertion of popular power, because we have a completely corrupt governing class going right up to the Supreme Court.
Democrats are also calling on Justice Clarence Thomas to recuse himself because his wife was involved in efforts to overturn Biden's win. A 50-hour filibuster by Missouri Democrats has ended a Republican push to make it harder to amend the state's constitution. Supporters of abortion rights say they've collected enough signatures for a ballot measure to restore access. Democratic State Representative Crystal Quaid says the Republican bill would have required both a statewide majority and majorities from five of Missouri's eight districts to pass it.
We have abortion access on the line this year, and so we know that the Republicans absolutely want to make it harder for citizens' voices to be heard to try to stop that.
Since the overturning of Roe, ballot initiatives to restore abortion rights have passed in seven states. Finally, four states hold primaries today: Georgia, Kentucky, Oregon, and Idaho. A ballot initiative aims to get rid of Idaho's closed primary system. Margaret Kinzel with Mormon Women for Ethical Government says that would improve civil discourse and give moderate candidates a better chance.
You have to appeal to a broader range of voters in order to make it through both the primary and the general election. And we're just hoping that that's going to create more conversations between candidates and their constituents.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Advocates of expanding civic engagement say there are many under-the-radar ways in which certain populations are shut out by the democratic process. When it comes to redistricting, a person's incarceration status affects how they're included in the drawing of new political maps. A new Minnesota law bans a controversial practice related to those counts. Mike Moen reports.
Minnesota's legislative session wrapped up over the weekend. One of the actions lawmakers did take was banning so-called prison gerrymandering. The provision was part of an elections policy bill quickly signed by Governor Tim Walz. Under such laws, state and local governments are required to count incarcerated people at their last home addresses when drawing new political boundaries after each census. Supporters say that prevents a community hosting a prison from gaining greater representation by including these individuals in their population totals. During earlier debate, House Democrat Esther Igbaje said when these protections aren't in place, there's a negative ripple effect.
And what it also means is that the home communities where prisoners had come from have lost a portion of their political power in the state because of that population miscount.
Some Republican opponents argued that communities with prisons have to stretch their resources. Local government shouldn't lose out on funding if those held inside are counted as living elsewhere. But supporters of these law changes say this is increasingly becoming a bipartisan issue, with conservative states like Montana implementing similar bans. Organizations like the Prison Policy Initiative say the movement reflects the need to fix a long-standing flaw within the U.S. Census Bureau. Igbaje echoed those thoughts.
While the Census Bureau has not yet decided to act, Minnesota can use its power to reallocate the data that comes from the census every 10 years to ensure a more accurate count.
In situations where an incarcerated person has a last home address outside of Minnesota or no home address at all, they're excluded from redistricting counting but are still added to the statewide population total. Nearly 20 states have either banned or restricted prison gerrymandering, and many local governments across the country have adopted bans as part of their redistricting. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member at any time during this broadcast by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. You can also text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Trans Positive PDX. Then at 7, EcoJustice Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow, there's a 50% chance of rain in the Portland area with a high of 60. Today in history, in 1881, the American Red Cross is established by Clara Barton in Washington, D.C. The quote of the day is from English poet Alexander Pope, who was born this day in 1688. He said, quote, "All seems infected, that the infected spy, as all looks yellow to the jaundiced eye." South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is calling on tribes to sign law enforcement deals with her government. But it comes at a tense time. Noem has been banned from many reservations around the state for a variety of derogatory remarks made about Native groups. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Governor Kristi Noem is calling on tribes to join law enforcement agreements with the state to combat public safety issues on reservations. As SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports, that comes amid tense relations between the administration and tribal governments.
Governor Noem is asking tribal governments to enter into mutual aid agreements to help address public safety issues and jurisdictional loopholes on reservations. Tribal police don't have jurisdiction over non-tribal members. Noem made the comments during a press conference Friday morning, where she continues to urge tribes to banish cartels instead of her.
And it is impacting every single community in the state, and I'm hopeful that we can get new partnerships with tribal leaders that will want to work together to enforce tribal law and to bring law and order to areas in a way that we haven't done before.
Some tribal leaders say Governor Noem should apologize for comments she made in March about Native children and parents. They say an apology could lead to constructive dialogue between the state and tribes. Troy Heinert is a former Democratic state lawmaker and president of the Intertribal Buffalo Council. He says lack of public safety issues are well known, and tribes need allies in advocating for federal funding.
She's burned so many bridges on so many other issues and hasn't shown any type of respect to tribes. And so the message of more funding for public safety is coming from all sides. You know, sometimes it's in how you say it.
The Oglala Sioux tribe is suing the federal government for its public safety funding formula. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland visited Southern California last week, where she met with federal, state, tribal, and local officials and community members. According to the Interior Department, she was there to learn about their vision for conserving the area's natural and cultural resources and explore energy options through the proposed establishment of Chuckwalla National Monument and the expansion of Joshua Tree National Park. Haaland met with local elected leaders, business owners, and others who've helped shape the proposal. Haaland also announced new funding from the Biden administration to clean up orphaned oil and gas wells, and the next phase in the department's orphaned well cleanup program through matching grants. Forge Project, a Native-led nonprofit organization that works to cultivate and advance Indigenous leadership in arts and culture, recently announced 6 winners of its 2024 fellowship. Delbert Anderson, a Navajo jazz trumpeter, composer, and educator. Sean Matthew Duncan, a United Kitawa Band of Cherokee Indians documentary filmmaker. Donna Hoger Hughes, a Stockbridge Munsee Mohican basket maker. Lindsay McIntyre, an Inuit award-winning filmmaker. Michaela Patton, an Oglala Sioux Lakota artist and sculptor. And Sterling Anthony Schreiber, a Stockbridge Munsee advocate for food sovereignty and food security, are the recipients. They're being recognized as a diverse group of Indigenous thinkers, artists, and activists working in Native North America. In a statement, Forge Project Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality, Sarah Biscara-Dilly, said they look forward to supporting the recipients' time in residence to take uninterrupted time to work, engaging others to a public or invitation-only program, or to rest. Each Forge Project fellow receives a $25,000 grant and has access to the Forge Project site, libraries, and collection of contemporary art by Indigenous artists during 3-week rotating fellowships. I'm Jill Freitas.
Portland's tourism industry still hasn't recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Last year, downtown Portland hotels sold just over 2 million rooms. That's a 9% increase from 2022, but remains 21% below pre-pandemic levels. The rates put Portland below other major West Coast cities. Downtown's hotel occupancy was 56% in 2023, well below Seattle's 68% and Vancouver, BC's 79%. This, according to data presented at Travel Oregon's annual State of the Industry event last week. Marcus Hibden is the communications director for Travel Portland, a hospitality nonprofit. Speaking with the Oregonian, Hibden cited Portland's reputational issues as responsible for the drop in tourism. Hibden referenced citywide polling that showed residents still have a negative impression of downtown. This despite police statistics showing a huge decline in downtown crime starting in 2023. Negative perception has been fueled by a public ad campaign across downtown funded by local delinquent taxpayer Kevin Looper. Looper is one of the co-founders of the reactionary advocacy group People for Portland. Their billboards have demonized District Attorney Mike Schmidt and County Chair Jessica Vager Pedersen by falsely portraying Portland as experiencing, quote, record crime. Mayor Ted Wheeler has questioned People for Portland's strategy of public fear-mongering, saying, quote, we're competing against other cities all around the country for jobs, for investments, for tourism. We're making it really, really easy for our competition when we have billboards that say, we suck really badly here, end quote. Hibden asserted that negative perception lags behind the reality in Portland. The Colorado legislature took a major step to improve youth mental health in the state when it made the I Matter program permanent by putting it in state statute and funding it at $5 million. The program provides students 21 and younger up to 6 therapy sessions at no cost. Eric Galatas has more.
Amanda Dodson first noticed signs for a pilot program called I Matter at her 10-year-old daughter Haley's school. After looking into it, she was able to get Haley in to see a therapist for free to address a diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactive disorder. Dodson says the experience has been life-changing. Haley is able to visit a therapist, play games, have snacks, and feel completely comfortable talking about her experiences and learning coping skills.
The therapist even follows up with us as parents and recaps what it is that they're working on together, and it feels like a family effort at this point to help her get the support she needs.
Colorado became the first state in the nation to provide free access to mental health care for all students after lawmakers made the iMatter program permanent in this year's session. Students can receive up to 6 free therapy sessions and connect with case managers if additional care is needed by filling out a form at imattercolorado.org. The iMatter pilot has helped some 12,000 Colorado youths access more than 50,000 free therapy sessions in 63 of the state's 64 counties since 2021. State Senator Daphna Michelson-Janay, who helped launch the pilot, believes the program will continue to help young people get back on a steady path.
Our kids are struggling in ways that other generations have not struggled, and it is incumbent upon us to recognize that need for therapeutic assistance and support and be able to provide it.
A recent Healthier Colorado Inseparable poll found that 9 in 10 Colorado voters strongly support making no-cost mental health services available to struggling youths. Dodson says making the iMatter program permanent shows the state is taking mental health seriously.
I just have been excited to see iMatter happening and being advertised, and I'm happy to have gotten into this program, and I would really love for everyone to have the same opportunity.
This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connection.
Dangerous heat waves are becoming more common as the climate crisis intensifies. There are things that local governments can do, however. Miami-Dade County installed 1,700 AC units for residents in public housing last year. Dr. Anthony Lysowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lysowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The federal government requires all public housing to be heated to keep residents warm. But it does not require cooling, so during heat waves, people may be at risk of heat stroke and other heat-related illnesses, especially as the climate warms. So Miami-Dade County has taken action on its own. Jane Gilbert is the county's chief heat officer. She says for decades, the county has required all new and redeveloped public housing to have air conditioning.
But our existing buildings, still many of them have maybe one old wall unit and it's a four-bedroom unit, or they didn't have any AC.
So last year, the county installed 1,700 air conditioning units in public housing.
We wanted to make sure all the bedrooms had access to cooling.
She says the recipients have expressed how having AC has improved their lives.
They can sleep at night. They can stay at their home and not have to camp out at a library all day. Their kids were able to get their homework done and do better in school.
And they're better able to stay safe and comfortable even as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Portland commuters may experience temporary delays over the coming weeks due to the filming of a movie. The Night Always Comes stars Vanessa Kirby and is an adaptation of Oregon author Willie Vlauten's novel of the same name. Kirby recently received an Oscar nomination for Pieces of a Woman. The Night Always Comes depicts a working-class Portlander fighting for financial stability. Vlauten's novels Lean on Pete and The Motel Life have also been adapted into films. The book is set in a Portland landscape rapidly changing due to gentrification. Portlanders traveling across the Broadway Bridge today can expect 3 to 5 minute delays from 6 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Similar delays are expected tomorrow on the Burnside Bridge between 1 and 3:30 p.m., as well as on Friday, June 12th, on the Hawthorne Bridge between 2 and 5 a.m. All sidewalks are expected to remain open during filming. You're listening to a Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, Eric Galatas, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening.